Welcome to the Displacement Urbanism podcast series, hosted through the London School of Economics. My name is Dr. Romola Sanyal, and I am Associate Professor in Urban Geography at the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. In this podcast series, we explore how cities and displacement co-constitute each other. As we see millions of displaced people moving to cities and millions of people displaced in cities around the world, the questions of how these processes intersect are crucial. In this podcast, I will be interviewing a range of actors, including those who have been displaced in different ways and those who are involved in the management and the study of displacement. We will be going around the world to explore the different issues around this topic. I hope the podcast offers an opportunity to open up conversations around the politics and processes of displacement and urbanization, the different ways it can be experienced, understood, and approached. I also hope that the podcast demonstrates how these are global and interconnected issues, but also one that draws our attention to its local specificities. Welcome to today's episode, which is titled Dispersal Cities, Accommodating Asylum Seekers in Britain. I'm pleased to introduce our speaker for today, Professor Jonathan Darling, who is a professor of human geography at Durham University. His research focuses on the spatial politics of asylum, sanctuary, and solidarity movements, and the urban dynamics of forced migration. He's worked in this field for over 15 years, undertaking research examining systems of refugee support, solidarity initiatives, and the role of urban green space on integration. His most recent book, Systems of Suffering, Dispersal, and the Denial of Asylum, published by Pluto Press, explores the UK's system of housing and support for asylum seekers and refugees. Welcome to the podcast, Johnny.
Hi, thanks. It's lovely to be here today and to be able to discuss some of these topics with you. Thanks.
So I wanted to sort of open with talking about your book. So your book focuses on the process of dispersal. Would you be able to outline what that means and how it connects to urban Britain and cities in the UK?
Yeah, sure. So dispersal is, in effect, the policy that's been used by the UK government since 2000 to distribute people who are in the asylum system across the country for accommodation and support whilst they're awaiting decisions on their asylum claim from the UK government. So prior to this point, prior to 2000, there was no such kind of centralised distribution of people. People were largely kind of accommodated by local governments in a quite ad hoc measure. And this led to quite a lot of tensions between local and central government over where people were housed and where costs were accrued in terms of support and infrastructure. And there was no kind of centralized kind of logic behind this. So from 2000, the then New Labour government decided that they wanted to kind of manage this more effectively, but they also wanted to manage it in a way that was linked to a series of other measures that they brought in place to try and deter people from seeking asylum in the UK. And we see a lot of the echoes of that policy landscape today in current policies. So dispersal was a means to try and manage a population, in this case asylum seekers, but also to try and disrupt forms of social networks and support for people who are in the asylum system. So disrupting kind of community connections, these kind of things. So what that meant in effect was that if you arrived on the south coast of England and sought asylum, you might be accommodated initially for a week or two in an initial accommodation centre on the south coast before then being bused to a town or city across predominantly the north of England, parts of Wales and Scotland for accommodation. And this was provided through local authorities who offered housing as part of their social housing stock. And why this kind of made such a difference to the landscape of asylum in the UK, and why it's particularly important, I think, to discuss in relation to the urban questions that you're developing through these podcasts, is because prior to this point, asylum and refugee resettlement were predominantly kind of focused upon London and larger cities, Birmingham to some extent and Manchester. But really, the question of supporting or accommodating asylum seekers was not something that extended beyond that in the UK in any large numbers. And dispersal, in effect, produced a system where cities in the UK came into contact with asylum seekers in a way that they hadn't done previously. So places like Leeds, Sheffield, Newcastle, Middlesbrough, these all became kind of initial dispersal centres. So places where social housing could be used to accommodate asylum seekers whilst the state is making decisions on their claims. And this then obviously has knock-on effects. So one of those knock-on effects was that as people received refugee status, they might decide to settle and stay within the place that they've been dispersed. So you started to see over a period in the early 2000s, new kind of refugee communities emerging in parts of urban Britain that hadn't had that those kinds of communities residing there before. And you also started to see a growth of migrant rights organisations and refugee support organisations growing up in these cities to support those people who are accommodated, whether that be in terms of community initiatives like drop-in centres, food banks and other forms of kind of community support, or more kind of centralised experience amongst local government in terms of being able to recognise the educational needs of new refugees, or recognising the requirements around education, training and employment opportunities. So you start to see a kind of a shifting landscape where certain cities, particularly in the north of England, in Scotland and in Wales, began to really develop expertise around supporting refugees that really wasn't there kind of 5 or 10 years prior to that.
You mentioned social housing. That's a really interesting point. This is often seen as a controversial topic where studies have shown tensions between different groups of people, including asylum seekers, over this particular resource, in addition to other resources, obviously. Have you come across this in your work?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting question. I think there are two kind of things to say here. So firstly, what's interesting about the use of social housing is that we saw a use of this in the early phases of dispersal. So between 2000 and 2012, when local authorities were broadly in charge of dispersal and accommodating asylum seekers, you saw the use of some social housing to accommodate asylum seekers and some contracted through private landlords, but that was much less prevalent at that point. What was particularly marked at this stage was that those local authorities that were involved, and particularly those cities that were involved, tended to be areas with larger stock of social housing, but they were very hard to let, in effect. And so there was a kind of an imperative for local authorities to be involved in dispersal, because this was one way in which they could draw down a relatively kind of stable rent income from properties that they were finding hard to let to other groups, whether that be within the population of British citizens or beyond that to other migrant groups. So in those senses, this idea of a competition for resources, certainly the early phase of dispersal, wasn't actually borne out by the kind of reality, but it was also, I guess, weaponized by government as a means to try and distinguish asylum seekers from other groups. So alongside housing, you also had the creation of an entirely separate support structure for asylum seekers at this stage, removing people from the welfare system as a mainstream system and placing them in a parallel system that was pegged at a third of any kind of income that would be provided to any British citizen through welfare. So you started to see a kind of a complete parallel track designed to clearly differentiate these groups of people. And that also then has the effect of again, kind of creating this sort of sense of a competition for resources that isn't always borne out in the reality. What we've seen since then is that since 2012, the accommodation for asylum seekers has been outsourced to a series of private contractors. So no social housing would therefore be used under this this new system and the system that's been in place for the last decade. And so that kind of argument around kind of social housing has sort of been dismantled to some extent. But at the same time, there's still a kind of a perception around the expense. So the contracts for private accommodation are extremely expensive, and partly that's profiteering by private contractors. And so, again, you start to see this kind of sense of a competition of resources actually being about questions of prioritization of who is benefiting from these systems and where profit is being produced. And I think the wider point I'd make on social housing more generally, and this is something that I kind of turned to in the book, is trying to situate and understand the accommodation of asylum seekers as not something which is separate from the wider challenges that a country like Britain is facing around housing. So if we do indeed have a housing crisis that many housing scholars have argued for a number of years, we've not been building enough housing. We've also allowed property to be left empty when it could be used for a whole variety of different purposes. Then really we shouldn't be situating asylum support and support for newly settled refugees as separate to that wider concern about marginalized groups within society who have a right to shelter and a right to housing. Some aspects of solidarity movements and support for housing rights that are trying to break down those barriers and to actually try to forge forms of solidarity across communities where there is a recognition of a shared struggle for the right to housing or a shared struggle against exploitative landlord practices. We can situate this as part of a wider struggle around housing rights that is really beginning to take hold in Britain. I think it's probably behind the kind of pattern that we've seen in other Western European countries. Asylum accommodation should not be seen as separate from that. It's part of the wider struggles around what the state should be, what citizens and non-citizens should be expecting of the state and the forms of support that can be anticipated within that context.
I also had a question about the role of local governments. So what do you think their role is in this process? And how important have they been in shaping the reception conditions of asylum seekers and refugees?
So local governments have played quite an interesting role across the kind of history of dispersal and increasingly today as well. They've sort of their involvement has kind of waxed and waned over the last sort of 15 years or so. So initially, local governments were essential to dispersal because central government and the Home Office basically relied upon local governments to be doing the work of accommodating asylum seekers and also to be doing the work of trying to provide some level of initial support and kind of move on into refugee status if people were successful in their asylum claims. So local government was important in terms of integration, in terms of providing links into education and healthcare resources and other kind of aspects. And that's where, you know, in response to the first question, I was kind of talking about how you start to see a new landscape of asylum being produced in this period in Britain. And this is where we really see that kind of bearing fruit in terms of elements of investment into local government involvement in asylum and sort of a recognition that asylum is now something that local governments have oversight of. That all changed in 2012 with the outsourcing of those asylum accommodation contracts, because that meant that local government in effect no longer received any funding or support around asylum and refugee issues. And where there was expertise, that tended to now either be kind of passed out into the private sector or tended to be much more stripped back so that elements of what were formerly specialised services around asylum and refugee support become integrated into wider kind of multicultural services or broader intercultural dialogue kind of services within local authorities. And again, if we think about the timing of this, this also coincides with periods of austerity in the kind of 2010s and the sort of chipping away of many aspects of the local state. This kind of story of almost a retreat of local government, we might think of in terms of asylum, is part of a wider kind of set of changes to the local state in Britain. What we've seen more recently, though, is a really interesting kind of almost resurgence or revival of the role of some local authorities around this. Partly this comes as a result of the responses to what might be termed the refugee crisis in Europe in 2015 and 16, and the UK's emergence of the Syrian Vulnerable Persons Resettlement Scheme, so a scheme to resettle refugees from Syria directly to local authorities in Britain. This was distinct from dispersal in the sense that it wasn't solely focused upon urban centres. So there are a number of rural communities who are involved in resettling Syrian refugees quite early in that process. And the distinction here was that funding from central government followed those refugees to local authorities. And so you started to see almost the reawakening of aspects of support infrastructure within local governments that had been lying dormant for periods of time. And also you saw refugee support organisations that had been built up through initial periods of dispersal, again, kind of enhancing their role in response to things like the Syrian resettlement. So this kind of meant that we've started to see a slightly greater sense of assertiveness from some local governments around asylum and around refugee rights, and trying to kind of challenge central government. As you know, the UK is a very centralised state, and so the Home Office has quite a lot of control over these issues and largely sets the tone of policy and the tone of political discussion on these issues. And so we've started to see grassroots organisations trying to affect local government to try and influence national government, including in terms of intervening into where people are accommodated and trying to push back at the housing standards that are being provided by private contractors and the types of accommodation that's being provided. So, for example, in the northeast of England, where I live and work, there've been a series of campaigns trying to influence local government, which have been successful in influencing local government, to try and challenge accommodation contractors over their use of room sharing amongst asylum seekers in accommodation, and trying to place limits on the number of people that can be accommodated in any one property. These kinds of pushes to try and really hold accommodation providers to account, which hasn't always been the case across that 10-year period of dispersal being run by private contractors.
I want to pick up a couple of the points that you made and talk about the current condition and focus a little bit on the accommodation question that you raised. One thing I'm particularly interested in unpacking is how that leads to creating new kinds of geographies. And in the beginning, you talked about how the dispersal system had been urban before, and that, you know, you've had certain schemes which are not necessarily urban anymore. But also we see more and more people being housed in more institutional settings, like in RAF bases in quite rural areas. So would you say that we're seeing the emergence of some forms of camps here, or some kind of a hybrid situation between camp and urban? Do you think that urban housing historically has enabled more interaction and less camp-like conditions for asylum seekers?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I think it's interesting because it picks up on one of the key distinctions between the UK experience and the experience of a variety of other Western European countries, where there's probably a longer history of the use of what you might think of as institutional spaces to accommodate people in the asylum system. So places like former military barracks or kind of former institutions that have been converted into forms of accommodation. Historically, the UK hasn't utilised those kinds of spaces as much as some of our European neighbours. The UK has tended to rely upon only initial accommodation of that form and then dispersal into communities. And I've often, and many others have often thought that this is actually one of the positives of the UK model, has been this kind of focus upon forms of community-based accommodation. It, you know, there have been many challenges and problems with that in terms of the quality of that accommodation, in terms of the standard that accommodation is expected to meet and often fails to meet, but also in terms of the types of support that are offered to people through dispersal. But irrespective of those kind of challenges, which are significant, there is something important, I think, about the principle, but also the practice of accommodating people within wider communities, partly because that offers opportunities for connection and opportunities for the emergence of forms of intercultural dialogue and forms of solidarity potentially. And we've seen that in some of the migrant rights organizing and work that happens across the UK. Ironically, one of the kind of, I think, unintended consequences of dispersal as a process has actually been to see the emergence of forms of political contestation and political challenge to the state in terms of anti-deportation activism and in terms of actually very supportive social networks and community organizations that view people in the asylum system as neighbors rather than as strangers. And so I think actually those forms of kind of community-based housing are really important as a mechanism to achieve that. That isn't to say that there aren't challenges there, of course, and I wouldn't for a second want to kind of over-romanticize the notion of dispersal accommodation or people's experiences of that. There are also many experiences, and I document some of these in my book, of widespread kind of forms of low-level harassment, of racism, of violence. But there is, I think, an important distinction to being accommodated within a community to being accommodated in an institutional setting. So that kind of picks up, I think, on a little bit on the second part of your question. But to go back to the first, I think the UK, as I said, hasn't had this same history of institutional settings, but we started to see that particularly in the period kind of from about 2018 to today. So punctuated slightly by the pandemic and the effects of that, we started to see the use of former RAF bases as forms of temporary accommodation initially, but then becoming much more kind of sedimented as a normal way of accommodating people in the asylum process. And this is part of government policy now to, in effect, expand the use of institutional sites like RAF bases as kind of camp-like spaces. And we can think about these as camp-like in a variety of ways, in the sense that they are institutional setups with kind of regulated entry and exit points with fencing and so on. And whilst there may not be strict regulations around entry and access at all times, so people are free to come and go within certain hours, the spectacle and the kind of the messaging of the barbed wire fence, of the distinction between being accommodated in this site to being accommodated in the community, is very stark. And these have also been shown to be sites of considerable risk for people in the asylum system, both in terms of public health risks. So we've seen a variety of outbreaks of not only COVID, but a series of other communicable diseases in overcrowded institutional settings in Britain. But also these are sites of risk for re-traumatization for people who may have been through incredibly violent and traumatic experiences, often at the hands of police or state forces in their home countries. To then be accommodated in institutional settings is potentially argued to be re-traumatizing by a variety of UK and other charities, and the UN has highlighted this as one of their concerns about this move in the UK. So all of these kind of factors are influencing the landscape of accommodation. And the kind of wider point here is that they're moving asylum seekers away from community forms of support and networks that might have been developed. They're moving people away from that kind of landscape of support that dispersal produced in some ways, and reiterating this sense of a distinction and division between asylum seekers and other citizens and residents of the UK. So we can think about this as being quite a significant turn, I think, within these processes. But I think this kind of institutional move is really quite significant. And the final thing that it's doing is that it's also, again, kind of remapping aspects of the landscape of where asylum seekers are placed within the UK. So increasingly institutional sites like Scampton in Lincolnshire, for example, is a former RAF base slated to be used to accommodate asylum seekers. This is quite a rural location. in distinction from some of the more urban settings that have built up these forms of support and networks around asylum in Britain. So again, a kind of reworking of that geography in different ways.
The last thing I wanted to ask you was, given your previous work and your ongoing work, what do you think the future holds? And what kinds of actors do you see emerging in the UK who would be involved with the support and accommodation of asylum seekers?
I think there's two kind of two trajectories to consider here. And it's obviously difficult to kind of envision futures at this current juncture for I'm sure many listeners to this are aware of the kind of political context in the UK at the moment is febrile, but it's also quite pointed in its hostility towards people in the asylum system. And I think it's intentionally produced as such for a whole variety of reasons. And so, you know, there are different directions of travel. I think one of those is to think about the extent to which we're seeing the solidification of a set of trends that have been kind of entrained since the early 2000s. So when I first started studying aspects of asylum accommodation and support in Britain, we started to see the kind of the emergence of efforts to deter people from seeking asylum in Britain, despite the fact that there is no evidence to suggest that these policies are successful or that decision making of people seeking asylum is determined by the specific policies of welfare or accommodation of any Western European state. But despite this, there's still a kind of emotional and effective draw of trying to be shown to be tough or trying to be shown to deter people. So that's where we get the kind of focus upon hostility, what Theresa May termed the hostile environment, for a variety of different forms of migrants, but asylum seekers are very much included within that. And so where we are now, I think, is the kind of almost the logical conclusion of a lot of those policies around trying to deter people. And so the rise of institutional settings as opposed to community-based housing, the use of floating barges to accommodate people as a kind of temporary measure, but increasingly as a more kind of permanent state of emergency and really poor quality and overcrowded conditions within those environments. These are really, I think, the logical conclusion of a decision to really strip away the rights of asylum seekers within Britain and to actually further entrench a division between people who are seeking to access a legal right that they have to seek sanctuary in a safe country and other aspects of the population, and to really kind of drill down on that sense that there is a distinction and division here. So all that said, I think, again, there's kind of two directions. So one is that pathway is further entrenched, and we see a kind of successful division between people in the asylum system who are subject to hostility, to punitive conditions and to harm, and to people who are resettled to the UK as refugees, who come through other routes, such as the Syrian resettlement scheme, such as Afghan resettlement scheme, and the Ukrainian, various Ukrainian visa schemes. These groups become positioned as the acceptable face of refugee politics in Britain. And in some ways, they become a kind of moral alibi through which the hostility of other groups is kind of legitimated. And I think we can see this in some ways, this isn't new, right? You know, the new Labour government of the late 90s, early 2000s, sought to divide and categorise groups of refugees into this kind of good and bad, genuine and suspicious. But really, what we've seen in the last few years is a kind of a weaponization of that distinction and a real kind of embedding of it throughout the asylum process, such that asylum itself is kind of under threat, I think, in in anything but name in the UK kind of context in terms of the right to seek safety here. The flip side, of course, of this is that there are also forms of response and forms of incredible community organizing, solidarity initiatives, and of groups who have built their resources and their kind of capacity to respond to kind of state violence in this way over the last 20 years of doing that work, of trying to respond to the harms of the asylum system. And that stretches from everything from hosting networks, which provide kind of a spare room to people who've reached the end of the asylum process and might otherwise be destitute or be forced from the country, all the way through to campaigning and lobbying groups trying to push back and create legal challenges to the right of the state to accommodate people on barges or to use institutional accommodation, and to really hold power to account in various different ways. So I think there are different directions that can take. One is to challenge the state and its actors at face value, to say, you know, if you're an accommodation provider, you have a contract to provide a certain standard of accommodation, you need to provide that. And if you're not, then there needs to be consequences for that. But at the same time, that work has to be, I think, connected to a longer term process of arguing against exclusionary migration controls and exclusionary policies around distinguishing asylum from refugee rights and reinstating the right to asylum in a country like Britain. You know, Britain is, despite austerity and despite its many challenges at this present moment in time, still comparatively a very rich country and still comparatively takes a tiny fraction of the world's refugees. The number of people in the asylum system at any one period of time is a tiny proportion of that wider kind of context. And so when viewed in those terms, these are not insurmountable policy problems, and nor are they challenges that really deserve the kind of hostility that has been focused upon them by government in that way. And then the final thing I think I'd say is that, as I mentioned, in terms of housing, there's a need to really situate asylum accommodation as part of a wider debate about housing in Britain. But I think there's also a need to situate the question of how we as a society want to respond to people who are seeking sanctuary. What kinds of moral responsibilities does the UK have for its relationship with the wider world, particularly in a post-Brexit context? And I think asylum, again, shouldn't be divorced from that conversation about the kind of moral and political responsibilities that we as a, you know, relatively wealthy society in Western Europe have towards the wider world. So I think those are the kind of directions that I think we need to be thinking about and working towards.
Thank you. That was a really fantastic ending to this conversation. Many of us really hope that we can come to a place where there's more kindness and less cruelty. It's really frustrating that the conversation and the policies have headed in a more cruel direction and the harms that it causes different groups of people. Thank you so much for that really interesting conversation and for talking about the work that you've done, your book, the experiences that you've had. It's been a real privilege to have you on this podcast. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to discuss this all with you. And yeah, I've really enjoyed it.